Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Zimbabwe's vice president is removed from party leadership. Liberia moves ahead with plans for an election. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. The AFP News Service reports that the vice president of Zimbabwe has been effectively banned from the leadership of the ruling ZANU-PF party after receiving stiff opposition from the wife of President Robert Mugabe. Vice President Joyce Mujuru has been accused by Grace Mugabe of fomenting factionalism and of extorting money from companies. The vice president has also been accused of plotting to assassinate President Mugabe. Mujuru was blocked from seeking a seat on the party's central committee. Several of her political allies were also prevented from running for seats on the committee. The action comes as both women angle to become the successor to the aging president. Congo's army is searching for Ugandan rebels in the eastern part of the DRC, according to the AFP News Service. The search follows the massacre of 100 people last week by suspected Muslim militants. The Associated Press reports that Liberian officials are going ahead with planned elections next month, an indication that the nation is bouncing back from the Ebola epidemic. The rate of Ebola infection has dropped to fewer than 100 cases weekly. The elections postponed earlier and rescheduled for December 16th will go forward. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling for an end to fighting in Libya. The Associated Press says the Secretary General expressed concern about the recent escalation of fighting. That includes an airstrike on a military base in Tripoli yesterday. This is VOA News. Reuters reports that the U.S. is warning travelers against threats of terrorism in Djibouti. The warning cites possible attacks against Western interests in that country. Reuters reports Nigeria's currency today reached a record low against the dollar. The central bank devalued the naira by 8% and raised interest rates. The bank was trying to overcome recent losses to its foreign reserves due to the drop in the price of oil, Nigeria's main export item. The Cameroon army has succeeded in freeing 16 hostages abducted by rebels from the Central African Republic last month. But the Democratic Front for the Central African People said today that they released the hostages as a gesture of goodwill, hoping to gain freedom for their leader who is jailed in Cameroon. The Reuters report quotes the Cameroonian government as saying a Polish Catholic priest was among those hostages released. Egypt today temporarily reopened the Rafah crossing into the Gaza Strip, the only opening to the territory not controlled by Israel. The border crossing was closed last October following a militant attack in the Sinai Peninsula. The opening will allow stranded Palestinians to cross from Egypt into the Gaza Strip, but will not allow traffic to go the other way. NATO's top military commander says a large number of Russian troops are still operating in eastern Ukraine, providing the backbone to separatists fighting government forces. U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove spoke to reporters in Kiev today after meeting with top Ukrainian officials. He said the United States remains committed to providing Ukraine support.
Part of our efforts with Ukraine, we are going to help Ukraine's military to increase its capacities and capabilities through our interactions with U.S. European Command and our joint commission, which is working closely with this nation at this moment.
General Philip Breedlove. Gunmen opened fire on a polio vaccination team in southwestern Pakistan today. At least four people were killed and a number were wounded. It happened in Quetta. Hong Kong authorities cleared a main protest camp today. They arrested two leaders of the Occupy movement. Movement members are trying to get greater democracy in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory. The AFP News Service quotes a spokesman for Aung San Suu Kyi's party as saying talks will be held soon on amending Myanmar's constitution. The constitution was put in place by the military junta that formerly ruled Myanmar, also called Burma. The junta wrote a document in such a way as to ban democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi from running for president. The talks were approved Tuesday by parliament. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
On November right now, the last time I stopped counting, it was over 1,400 in just the month of November. And that is the highest within a single month. I'm sure now it could have even go above 1,500 or 600. Because every day the numbers are increasing. There is no positive trend to see the numbers are decreasing.
That's Mohamed Sila, Country Director for International Aid Agency ActionAid in Sierra Leone. He says the Ebola virus continues to spread throughout the country. We'll have details coming up.
Also in the news, the U.S. and the U.N. are condemning increasing attacks against civilians in the DRC's North Kivu province.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Ebola virus continues to ravage Sierra Leone despite ongoing efforts by the government and international community to contain it. The country's president has made the virus a top priority on his agenda, scaling down other projects that were to be implemented. He has also committed over $20 million U.S. dollars to fight the disease. ActionAid's country director in Sierra Leone, Mohamed Sila, says the Ebola virus persists with the highest number of new cases reported to date this month.
On November right now, the last time I stopped counting, it was over 1,400. In just the month of November, and that is the highest within a single month. I'm sure now it could have even go above 1,500 or 600, because every day the numbers are increasing. There is no positive trend to see the numbers are decreasing. Now we have a lot of treatment facilities. Now we have more laboratories, but yet there are still some of the major towns that are being affected that do not have access to laboratories. So that's a big challenge. The numbers are still increasing amidst all the efforts.
So far, six doctors and over 100 frontline health workers have died from Ebola. What is the situation now regarding health workers? Do they have the necessary equipment and protection they need? And are there enough health workers in Sierra Leone right now battling Ebola?
We have a lot of health personnel. I mean, recently, even there were some volunteers from the UK that also came in. We have the Cubans on the ground. We have the Chinese on the ground. Like that, we are just overwhelmed by the enormity of the challenge. Actually, we have lost seven doctors. And even this week, again, there was a report about two doctors have got infected again. One is an Italian that has been taken out of the country, and another one that's a national is still within country and being treated. So this is very, very huge task for the health personnel.
What is needed now to reduce the spreading of the disease?
One of the key challenges I think we are facing currently, we do not have enough laboratories in all the districts. Ideally, it would have been nice if we have laboratories in each district so a suspected case can be quickly isolated, result is positive, and they can be taken to a treatment or holding center. Secondly, the holding facilities are overflowing. We do not have enough bed space to accommodate all the sick people that are currently showing signs and symptoms. That's another big challenge. And thirdly, because of the large number of people that are picking up the disease and you need to quarantine a lot of houses, there are many houses where Ebola victims have been picked up that have not been quarantined because you don't have enough security deployed to such places and they have not been supplied with food. People will leave the houses. They will move out of being isolated for 21 days because they are not being provided with food. And even up to now, the time it takes for positive results to come back to communities and therefore all those who are we associated with that one positive person to be isolated and actually secure so that they do not move. And unfortunately, there is a lapse in the security system. I just give an example of Kenema District, which had been isolated in August, and they had been doing very well at the district level. They had no new infections for nearly 1 month, and then we had a case. How did it happen? No one knows. Of someone who is infected moving out from Freetown to enter an isolated zone that she was not supposed to enter. How she entered there, no one knew. Definitely a weakness in the systems of allowing people to go into the zone that they are not supposed to enter.
How is Sierra Leone's government addressing these issues, as well as how is the international community responding to these major challenges?
The Sierra Leone government has been doing a lot even before the international support started coming in. And now, for sure, the one major thing they are confronting is how to coordinate all the support that is coming out from different sectors. Another challenge that could be facing is when some of the international funding that is coming is not going through government, it's going through different international NGOs and international institutions like the UN bodies. How to actually coordinate and have a grasp of the whole situation is a big challenge. I'll just give a simple example. In some districts where you have people who are responsible for handling corpses are being paid by international NGOs. In another case, you have situations where they are being paid by government. And so if there's a delay in payment of those that are handled by government, you see strikes. I mean, health workers who have not been paid displayed corpses of dead Ebola patients outside of the hospital as a sign of protest. And these are people that have been managed are supposed to be paid by government, and they have not been paid for over a month.
People's attitudes towards Ebola has also been very challenging over these months in trying to contain the virus. What do you see now as some of the biggest challenges in getting people to follow direction? And also, what is their attitude towards people who have been former Ebola patients?
What I can say probably has changed a bit is the acceptance of Ebola survivors. But what I've still not seen is the attitude of people. People still have the negative attitudes of doing the wrong things that will make them continue to get infection. We still have the challenge of people hiding sick people within their houses. We still have the challenge. There was even a very bad scenario recently when people had to go and exhume a dead Ebola body because they said they had to perform special traditional rites on the corpse. And that was even being championed by a local chief. So it just shows we still have a big challenge in the social mobilization to effectively get everyone on board. We all know if people have the positive attitude, we could easily tackle it. But ideally, even if we got all the hospitals and with all the facilities, if people don't change their attitude, we cannot easily get rid of the disease.
That was Mohamed Sila, Country Director for ActionAid. He spoke with me from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The head of the UN Ebola Emergency Response Mission says new infections in Sierra Leone have delayed the goals of treating more patients and increasing the rate of safe burials. UN envoy Anthony Banbury had predicted that isolated treatment and safe burial would reach 70% by December 1st. The UN mission failed to reach that goal because of increasing cases in rural parts of Sierra Leone, the city of Makini, Port Loko, and the capital Freetown. In neighboring Liberia, public gatherings were banned last month while hundreds of Liberians were contracting the Ebola virus each week. The ban continues even though the rate of new infections has slowed to about 100 per week. However, political candidates campaigning for the Senate election on December 16th are exempt from the ban. Meanwhile, at Langley Air Base in the U.S. state of Virginia, 90 U.S. military personnel have just returned from Liberia. They will now remain in isolation for 21 days. They will celebrate their traditional Thanksgiving holiday in relative luxury at the military base. They can watch big screen television of American football games while they wait for the end of their quarantine. They were among almost 2,000 military personnel and contractors sent to Liberia and Sierra Leone to build isolation and treatment centers.
The U.S. and the U.N. are condemning increasing attacks against civilians in the DRC's North Kivu province. They say at least 200 people have been killed since mid-October near the city of Beni. Women and children were among the victims. The attacks included beheadings, rapes, and mutilations. The U.S. State Department says the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, and others allegedly carried out the attacks. It says the ADF is an illegal Ugandan armed group.
Hundreds of prisoners have taken over the main jail in the Central African Republic, capital of Bangui. Security forces and international peacekeepers quickly surrounded the prison, and the United Nations mission in the country says the prisoners cannot escape. Nick Long has more from Bangui.
There were and may still be more than 700 prisoners inside Garagba Detention Center, a jail built for only 300. The prison has seen breakouts in the past year, and the UN has been warning in recent weeks that conditions inside the jail might lead to further trouble. On Monday, that trouble erupted. The The prisoners, some with weapons, took over the jail, exchanged gunfire with security forces outside the facility, and demanded talks with the head of the CAR prosecution service. One of the policemen standing guard outside the jail told VOA, on condition of anonymity, what he thought had sparked the protest.
L'un de leurs est décédé dans la maison d'arrêt.
He says one of the prisoners died of tuberculosis, so the prisoners have, as he puts it, gone on strike. They are demanding their rights, he says, as some of them have been held there for 10 months without trial. The policeman also said some prisoners had been firing at peacekeepers and throwing grenades, and one Burundian peacekeeper had been wounded. As of midday Wednesday, the situation was calm, but the standoff continued. Police Lieutenant Leo Frank Gnapier is with the UN mission in the CAR.
On ne peut pas dire que il y a contrôle. Les prisonniers sont effectivement dans la cour de la prison.
We can't say the prisoners are under control, he says, as they're in the prison courtyard. But he insists they're not outside and cannot get out because the place has been sealed off. He confirmed there have been casualties.
Il y a 13 blessés, mais les blessés, c'est pas nécessairement les blessés par balle.
He says 13 people have been wounded and evacuated from the area, but most do not have gunshot wounds as they were injured during the rioting in the jail. The incident is another sign of the chaos in the CAR, 20 months after Seleka rebels ousted the president. A transitional government has been unable to restore order or stop rampant violence and lawlessness around the country. Recently, the UN told VOA there used to be 60 prisons in the CAR, but many were damaged or destroyed by rebels over the past 2 years, and now only 4 of them are operational. Garagba prison was the biggest of those 4, and for the time being, it too is out of service. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
UN humanitarian officials say civilians are bearing the brunt of Somalia's conflict. They say more than 5,000 weapons-related injuries have been reported by 9 hospitals this year in Mogadishu, Kismayo, Doolal, Mudug, and Baidoa. Meanwhile, about 50,000 people have been affected by seasonal flooding along Somalia's Shabelle and Djuba rivers. Around 30,000 of them have been displaced. Tehran is the worst hit of the 6 regions affected by floods. The UN says humanitarian agencies are distributing to the needy hygiene kits, plastic sheeting, kitchen sets, blankets, and shelter materials, among other items. In other news on Somalia, about 9,000 suspected cases of measles have been reported this year. That's double compared to last year. The UN says there are large numbers of unvaccinated children in hard-to-reach areas in southern and central Somalia. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Ebola virus continues to ravage Sierra Leone despite ongoing efforts by the government and international community to contain it. And the U.S. and the U.N. are condemning increasing attacks against civilians in the DRC's North Kivu province. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The UN Security Council's patience with the two sides in South Sudan's deadly year-long conflict appeared to be running out yesterday. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports the council is closer to imposing targeted sanctions on the parties.
Australia's UN Ambassador Gary Quinlan, who's president of the 15-nation council this month, told reporters the council is very concerned about the political crisis that has killed thousands, left nearly 2 million people displaced, and 100,000 sheltering in makeshift UN protection camps. Ambassador Quinlan laid the blame for the misery squarely at the feet of President Salva Kiir and his political rival and former vice president Riek Machar.
The fact is, this is a man-made disaster and a violent power struggle between the two chief architects in South Sudan's political elite. It can be stopped if they were to move back from the current pursuit of their own selfish, narrow political interests, and that's a united view in the council.
He said the council decided some time ago that it is prepared to move forward with targeted sanctions if necessary, possibly including an arms embargo, and that some members have discussed possible measures among themselves. Peace talks between Mr. Kieran Mishar and Addis Ababa under the auspices of regional group IGAD have so far not delivered any deal. Ambassador Quinlan said the council has been taking its lead from IGAD and had given its mediators space to work toward a November 24th deadline for reaching an agreement. With no accord in sight, the council now will have to consider other options. Earlier Tuesday, during a vote to renew for another 6 months the 12,500-member UN peacekeeping force in South Sudan, that country's envoy, Francis Madang Deng, warned the council that a sustainable solution to the conflict cannot be achieved through sanctions. He said they only tend to harden positions toward confrontation rather than cooperation. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Nigeria's central bank has devalued its currency and raised a key interest to stabilize Africa's largest economy amid falling oil prices and ahead of national elections next year. Chris Stein has more from Abuja.
With oil trading below $80 a barrel for the first time in 4 years, the Central Bank of Nigeria this week acted to steady the economy in the run-up to February's presidential elections. Nigeria is Africa's largest oil producer, and the government generates 70% of its revenue from oil. The drop in global prices, caused in part by increased production in the United States and slowing demand in Asia, has become a cause for concern. The finance ministry last week announced it would rein in expenditures and place new taxes on luxury goods. The central bank on Tuesday lifted interest rates to 13% from 12% and raised its official peg for the naira to 168 against the dollar, from 155 previously. Bismarck Rawani heads Financial Derivatives Company, based in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. He says the central bank's moves are positive steps to keep the economy under control.
I think it was a move in the right direction, but I'm not too sure that it is, completely adequate, but it moves towards equilibrium.
However, devalued currency means businesses and individuals who get paid in naira but pay bills in foreign currencies will end up spending more. Both the government and Nigerians who work overseas will find doing business more expensive.
Even Nigerians whose kids are in schools overseas will have to bring them back. In some cases, they cannot afford to do it anymore. So the adjustments are both at the government, corporate, and individual levels.
Nigeria this year became Africa's largest economy after it changed the way it calculates its gross domestic product under President Goodluck Jonathan. Mr. Jonathan is running for re-election in February, and Rawani says the drop in oil prices means the ruling People's Democratic Party will have to do more to prove it's worth the voters.
The PDP will have to work much, much harder to convince people that they are in charge of things and they can control things, and that the future is going to be better than the past. Because it actually just makes people more desperate.
Rawani also warns that inflation may tick up in the new year, raising prices for consumers as the election grows near. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
Climate watchers will be focused on Lima, Peru, December 1st as representatives of 200 countries gather for crucial negotiations on a new climate treaty. It would replace the Kyoto Protocol, the global agreement that expired in 2012. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, hopes for success in this round of talks are boosted by recent agreements among the world's top polluters.
The meeting in Lima sets the stage for Paris in 2015, when nations will come together to agree on a binding climate treaty, says Jennifer Morgan, global director of the climate program at the World Resources Institute.
That all countries would be part of, which is one of the differences of the past, and that would stick around for a while. That would be a global agreement for decades to come. That would bring countries back to the table to strengthen their commitment to solving the problem.
Scientists affirm with increased certainty that the planet is getting hotter. Study after study shows that the world is well on its way toward a 2 degrees Celsius rise in temperature above pre-industrial levels. Experts say that would trigger extreme weather and rising seas, problems of global magnitude. The studies also show that climate-changing emissions from fossil fuels are to blame. Lima is about getting those emissions in check. Morgan points to growing momentum to get that done. In September, the United Nations held a climate summit to engage heads of state and industry leaders. And about 700,000 people crowded streets in New York City and elsewhere for the People's Climate March.
Then bounce into European heads of state in October saying, here's our offer to reduce at least 40% emissions. And then the U.S.-China announcement recently, where those two countries came forward in a pretty historic announcement of what they're willing to do on their numbers and their willingness to work together.
In that agreement between the world's top polluters, the U.S. committed to reducing emissions between 26 and 28% by 2025. And for the first time, China put a timetable on its actions, saying emissions would peak by 2030. Morgan says to get there, China must begin making massive cuts now.
It's not like they're going to wait 16 years. They actually have to shut down coal-fired power plants. They have to build up renewable energy. They have to be much more efficient in order to turn that curve.
The deal puts China in a leadership role for the first time. Other countries are expected to put their reduced emissions commitments on the table by March. Morgan says the U.S.-China announcement is a strategic move that could energize other nations to do more.
If you look at developed countries, it's fair to say that Australia or Canada haven't indicated when they are going to table their offer. Well, if China can offer something, certainly they can offer something too. And in developing countries, I think a country like India or Brazil, I think now are challenged to table their offers as well.
Morgan says it's critical to close the emissions gap between what is needed and what countries are expected to pledge. She says each nation will make reductions in its own way through national policies and laws, but only a global pact with binding commitments can exert pressure to get the job done.
So it's in the interest of every country to actually have a global approach so that they can be sure that what they're doing is being mirrored by others. You don't get that through bilateral deals. You don't get all of the emissions in place, and you don't take care of the most vulnerable countries around the world adequately. So you need to do this global. It's challenging, it's messy, but it's fundamental to move forward.
Morgan hopes that the Lima meeting will end with a text for a new treaty, one that will guide negotiators and lead governments to act. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
The International Monetary Fund says Egypt is on track for economic recovery after 4 years of severe political and social instability. An IMF delegation in Cairo says that new economic objectives established by the government of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi could achieve an economic growth rate of 3.5% in the coming months. Since the 2011 Arab Spring uprising, Egypt's growth rate has been about 2%. In other news, Cairo opened the Gaza border for 2 days to let stranded Palestinians return to Gaza. The military is demolishing hundreds of homes on the border to create a blockade against terrorists and arms smuggling. Cairo began building the blockade when 30 Egyptian soldiers were killed in a rocket attack last month. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.